Hi, everyone, and welcome back to For the Curious and Confused, a podcast for people who want to understand different perspectives of the world through the people who inhabit it. I'm your host, Don McTaggart, and today I'm joined by Terry Tucker, a motivational speaker, author, and international podcast guest. Terry has a business administration degree from the Citadel, where he also played D1 basketball, and a master's degree from Boston University. In his professional career, Terry has been a marketing executive, a hospital administrator, a SWAT team hostage negotiator, high school basketball coach, business owner, and motivational speaker, as well as others. He's also been battling cancer for the last 13 years. Terry's passionate about sharing stories of transformation and speaks on topics such as how to live your uncommon and extraordinary purpose and the four truths to leading a resilient life. He uses these ideas as practical guidelines to empower others in leading a more fulfilling and purposeful life. So, Terry, thank you for sharing your time with us today, and I'm excited to hear more about your story.
Well, Don, thanks for having me on. I'm really looking forward to talking with you today.
Very excited. So, could you first give us a 2-minute introduction into who Terry Tucker is and what motivates him?
Sure. So I was born and raised on the south side of Chicago. I'm the oldest of three boys. You can't tell this from looking at me or from my voice, but I'm 6'8" tall. And as you mentioned, I went to the Citadel on a basketball scholarship. When I graduated from the Citadel, I'm really going to date myself now, Don. This was long before the internet was available to help people find employment. I moved home to find a job. Fortunately, I found that first job in the corporate headquarters of Wendy's International, the hamburger chain, in their marketing department. That was the good news. The bad news was I lived with my parents for the next 3.5 years as I helped my mother care for my father and my grandmother, who were both dying of different forms of cancer. After Wendy's, I actually went to work for the hospital that cared for my father and my grandmother. Thought they did such a great job that I wanted to be part of that. And then at 37, made the major pivot in my life and became a police officer. And as you mentioned, part of what I did during my law enforcement career was I was a SWAT hostage negotiator. After that, I started a school security consulting business, coached girls' high school basketball. But for the last 13 years now, I've been battling this rare form of cancer, this rare form of melanoma. And then finally, my wife and I have been married for 32 years. We have one child, a daughter. She's a graduate of the United States Air Force Academy and is an officer in the new branch of the military, the Space Force.
Wow, that's so, you guys must be very proud. That's awesome.
Incredible pro. Yeah.
Wow. Okay, so to dig into a little bit of some of what you mentioned there, how was it moving back to live with your parents for a while? What did you learn about being an adult child, and like interacting with your parents in that sense?
Yeah, I mean, I had a great relationship. My brothers and I had a great relationship. I mean, we were all college athletes. My brothers and I have one brother who was drafted by the Cleveland Cavaliers in the National Basketball Association. So sports was our whole life growing up. And our mom and dad really supported that and taught us the value of family, of loving each other, of caring for each other, of supporting each other. And when it came time to sort of flip the script and take care of my father, who was literally dying in one bedroom, and literally next to him was my grandmother, my mom's mom, dying in another bedroom. It was a no-brainer. I mean, did I want to do it? No. I mean, I graduated from college. I'm the first person in my family to graduate from college. I'm looking to make my mark on the world, and then bang, this happens. But my parents have done so much for my brothers and I that it was like, if it would have taken 30 years to, and I had to live at home for 30 years and help them pass away, I would have done that because my parents, like I said, taught us and modeled what it means to be family. And this was a time to step up and kind of, I'm not going to say pay back everything they did for us, but it was certainly a time to say, all right, now it's my turn to help you. And I'll do that whatever in whatever way I possibly can. Until you're no longer with us. And that was a very difficult time in my life to that my grandfather, my grandmother and my father died within about 18 months of each other. So it was not a good time in my life, but it was a time that I am very grateful that I got to spend because it helped me to grow as a human being.
I would say, yeah, you don't hear a lot of people having those experiences anymore because, like you said, you graduate college and then you are off to make your mark on the world. And it often, even if they are in that period of life, it often is kind of a traveling back and forth briefly. But being able to have that extended time is really, really powerful and beautiful. So, what are some of the challenges that you're trying to help people address with what you do?
I mean, right now it's connections. I mean, one of the biggest things that is important to me right now is to have connections. I've been asked, how do you want to be remembered? I don't want to be remembered. I'm not going to be remembered. 100 years from now, nobody's going to remember I was here. And I'm fine with that. But what I want to do here today, and I don't think we do this enough, and I think it sort of is social media that prevents us from doing this, is to have those deep relationships, those deep connections with people. There's a professor at the University of Chicago, a psychology professor, who does this experiment with his students. The idea is you go out and you get on a bus, and in three questions, you become deep with somebody. So you sit down next to somebody, it's like, hey, how you doing? I'm fine, how are you? Question one, and I'm just making this up. Question two, what do you do for a living? Oh, I'm a doctor. Question three, have you always wanted to be a doctor? It doesn't matter what they answer, but whatever they tell you, they're telling you their why in life. They could say, no, I grew up on a farm and I wanted to be a veterinarian, but X, Y, and Z happened. Or my mother was a doctor and she died of breast cancer at 40, so I'm honoring her memory by being. Whatever they tell you, now you understand, or they reveal their why to you. Don, we don't do that anymore. We stay on the surface, social media, everything's great, everything's wonderful. Everything's not great, everything's not wonderful, but social media doesn't allow us to go deep with people. I love, at this point in my life, going deep, and I love trying to help other people to also go deep with their colleagues, their friends, and their family, because I just don't think we do that anymore in life.
I totally agree. The first thing I think of is that, like, when you're on the bus, the you can kind of get a sense, or you are projecting a sense that people don't want you to engage with you in that way. So I guess in how you approach this, do you do that kind of approach where you just say, hey, I'm going to figure out something about this person? And if you do or don't, do you gauge it based on if you think they'll be receptive, or do you just kind of hope to grab them and bring them into this? Or are you looking for people who seem receptive in the first place?
No, I'm looking to grab people and kind of shake them a little bit. I mean, it was something that I think I learned when I was a police officer. I mean, you could look at people, just look at their face, and you could tell what kind of day they were having. You're having a good day, having a bad day, kind of in the middle somewhere and like that. And I can look at that. And when I see somebody, especially that just looks like, I mean, it's 7 o'clock in the morning and it looks like they're already beat down for the day, I'll just look at them and be like, you don't look like you're having a good day today. And a lot of times that's, oh, somebody sees me. Somebody realizes, recognizes that I'm having this difficult day in my life. So I'll talk to anybody. I've never met a stranger. I mean, I love understanding what makes people tick. I mean, most of the books I read are biographies of, why did people do what they do? I'll give you a story. My wife has been in the financial services industry for over 40 years. And every year we used to go to the obligatory Christmas party. And I before we would go in, I would always say to my wife, all right, here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to go into the party and I'm going to find five of your colleagues. And at the end of the night, I'm going to come out and I'm going to tell you, where they went to school, how they met their spouse, what their kids do, everything about them. I said, and then Monday morning when you go to work, they're going to come to you and tell you what a great guy I am. Not because I am a great guy, but because I spent the entire time asking them about themselves. We're narcissistic. We love talking about ourselves, but rarely did anybody ever reciprocate with those questions. Where did you go to school? How did you meet your wife? What are your kids? That kind of thing. There was never usually a reciprocal process with that. So, and it used to drive her nuts because she would kind of roll her eyes at me. And I'd go in, I'd come out at the end of the night, get in the car, all right, on the way home. All right, here's the deal. Here's the deal with Bob. Here's the deal with Nancy. Here's the deal with Sally. And then Monday morning, like by noon, she would call me. She's like, I love you very much, but sometimes I hate you because these people would come into your office like, oh, your husband's a great guy. They didn't know one thing about me. I could have been an axe murderer for all they knew because they never asked me about me. But I like to draw people out. I think people enjoy engaging with. I mean, we're social animals. If COVID taught us anything, it's that we need each other. I mean, when we were isolated, divorce rates went up, drug abuse rates went up, alcoholism rates went up. We need each other to be happy and successful in life. So I always try to draw people out and get them to engage with me. They don't always do it, but I'm pretty adept just from my years of being a hostage negotiator of getting people to kind of talk to me in a non-threatening kind of way. I don't want anything from you. I just want to get to know you a little bit better.
I'm glad you brought back the hostage negotiator part, because earlier in that question you mentioned looks like you're not having a very good day, and that just screams Chris Voss to me, which I'm sure you're very familiar with his work. And for anybody who's not familiar, Chris Voss is also like a was he CIA or some a hostage negotiator that's
He was
pretty
with the
famous on the
FBI.
internet. FBI. Okay. But yeah, very accomplished negotiator in general. Yeah, and one of the things I like that he says is just make observations about what you think you see. And it doesn't matter if your observation is right or wrong. It's the fact that you're opening the door for them to either agree with you or correct you or whatever it is, and you're in the door at that bit.
It is. And I just finished a week of cancer treatment, and my wife was pushing me. I don't have a left leg. I had my leg amputated. I'm in a wheelchair. So we were getting on the elevator, and there was a young man standing there, and he had a backpack. He kind of had a bedroll and a blanket, and that in and of itself seemed kind of strange to me. It's like it's a hospital. We're not camping here, and that kind of thing. But we both got on the elevator, and I turned to him. And I just said to him, I said, "You don't look like you're having a good day." And he looked at me and he said, I wish I didn't have cancer." And I said, "I wish I didn't have cancer too." I said, "But you need to find meaning in your misery." And then the doors opened and we had to get off. I wish I could have talked to him more, but I don't know if he got anything out of that. But yeah, I mean, he was much younger than I am, and I kind of felt sorry for him. It's like, boy, I hope they caught it in time. I hope you're going to be okay. But he was obviously struggling with the fact that he has this disease. And like I said, I wish we could have spent some more time talking to each other.
Yeah, it sounds like one of those scenes in a movie where the connection happens and like the whole rest of the world kind of blurs out for a second, and then it's just the two people there. So yeah, it would have been nice to have been able to do that further. I guess this might be a good time to get into kind of what your cancer journey has been like, if you're okay with discussing some of that. So I think particularly the part you mentioned about you wish you didn't have cancer either, and I'm sure having your leg amputated has been quite challenging. So how have you contended with everything in that realm, and how do you still find meaning and purpose with such a large wall of despair? Or maybe that's the wrong word, but you know what I'm saying.
No, you're right. It is. I mean, there's good and bad in everything. 2012, I was a girls' high school basketball coach in Texas, and I had this callus break open, on the bottom of my foot. And initially, don't think much of it because as a coach, you're on your feet a lot. But after a few weeks of it not healing, I made it a point and went to see a podiatrist friend of mine, a foot doctor. And he took an X-ray and he said, "Terry, I think you have a cyst in there, and I can cut it out." And he did. And he just showed it to me. It was a little gelatin sac with some white fat in it. No dark spots, no blood, nothing that gave either one of us concern. But fortunately or unfortunately, he sent it off to pathology to have it looked at. And then 2 weeks later, I get the call from him. And as I mentioned, he's a friend of mine. And the more difficulty he's having explaining to me what's going on, the more frightened I am becoming. Until finally, he just lays it out for me. He said, "Terry, I've been a doctor for 25 years. And I have never seen the form of cancer you have. You have an incredibly rare form of melanoma. And most people think of melanoma as too much exposure to the sun, affects the melanin, the pigment in our skin. Mine has nothing to do with sun exposure. It's a rare form that appears on the bottom of the feet or the palms of the hands." And so he recommended I go to MD Anderson Cancer Center to be treated. And so I did. So they remove the bottom of my foot, they remove all the lymph nodes in my groin, and then they tell me I'll be dead in 2 years. So we have nothing to offer you. We have surgery. We have no drugs, no therapies, nothing that can help you. And I thought, well, okay, you gave me a death sentence. How can I try to turn that death sentence into a life sentence? And Don, don't get me wrong. I went through all the stages that we would associate with grief. First it was denial. I can't possibly have cancer. My father had cancer. I'd done everything right up to that point. I'd exercised, I'd eaten right, I've seen my doctor every year, I've had all the tests, I've done everything. I can't possibly have this cancer. And then you get angry. I can't possibly have this cancer. I've done everything right in my life. And then there was a bargaining phase. Our daughter was in high school when I was diagnosed. So it was kind of, hey, God, please let me live long enough to see her graduate from high school. Let me be involved in her life, in that regard. And then I got down, I got depressed, I felt sorry for myself. And then I just came out the other end and was like, this sucks, but I'm going to have to embrace the suck. I do not like the cards that I've been dealt, but I'm going to have to play these cards to the best of my ability. And, I mentioned before, finding meaning in your misery. I don't like this, but there's a reason I'm going through this. There's something I'm supposed to learn. I don't think we suffer in vain. It's not random. It's not arbitrary. We're supposed to learn something from this. And I'll give you two things that I have learned. Number one, I don't think you truly know yourself until you've been tested by some form of adversity in your life. It doesn't have to be cancer. It could be any kind of other thing. And secondly, cancer's made me a better human being. I've been asked if I could live my life over again without cancer, would I do it? And Don, I don't think I would. I mean, I'd go through everything I've been through again to make me a better human being, to make me a better man, to make me a better person that can connect with other human beings that are going through difficulty, they're going through adversity in their life. So I don't think I'd give up all the pain and the difficulty because I think in the end, the outcome is going to be much better for me having gone through all this.
Can you expand on that a little bit? Because that seems like something that might seem surprising to people of if you could go
Brain
back and
damage?
not having done it. Yeah. So, what are the set of circumstances and lessons that have come out of that could make that statement worthwhile and believable for you?
I spent so much of my life before cancer doing physical things. I was a college athlete. I was a police officer. I was on a SWAT team. I was an undercover narcotics investigator for a while. I did a lot of physical things. And now I'm in a wheelchair and I don't have a left leg. And I think when you can't do what you're good at, in all honesty, you do what's important. I mean, was playing college basketball important in the scheme of life? Not really. I mean, it was great. I got a free college education out of it and got to play against some really great players. But in the scheme of what's important in life, it really wasn't important. But I think the things I'm doing now, being guests on podcasts, writing, and things like that, are things that are going to make the world a better place in terms of the relationship, or at least I hope they're going to make the world a better place. And so it's finding those purposes. We always hear about purpose. Find your purpose in life and live it. And I can't speak for everybody else, but I can speak for myself. That word for me is plural. It's purposes. Like I said, I think when I was younger, it was to be an athlete. And then I think my purpose was to be in law enforcement. And now, in all honesty, as I'm probably coming to the end of my life, my purpose, I think, has shifted again to find as much goodness, positivity, motivation, love, to put all that back into the world with whatever time I have. And if you don't believe me, I always go back to Viktor Frankl, a guy who wrote Man's Search for Meaning. He was a concentration camp, a Holocaust survivor during World War II. And he wrote this great book. It's not a very long book. It's called Man's Search for Meaning. And he talks about in that book that we should not live our life in the abstract, that every one of us has a purpose, a reason that we were put on the face of this earth. And we almost have a moral responsibility to find that purpose in life and to live it.
I'm reading The Alchemist right now, which I think is kind of a similar to that idea, but as like a more narrative kind of woo-woo-ish kind of thing. But yeah, I really resonate with the part you said about when you can't do what you're good at, do what's important. I think that has played into my journey a little bit in my grad school journey, in that I had always sort of been the big fish in a little pond kind of thing, and like science always came relatively easily, and I always had good grades and things like that. And then you get to grad school, and man, you just get your butt kicked, and like everybody has been in that position, everybody's like that, and you're not the big fish anymore. And I struggled with that for a little bit of like how to still have value and do the program, not being like the smartest person anymore. And I think that has also reprioritized things for me as well, like doing this podcast. Like, this also feels like something that is more important necessarily than being the best in some field or something like that. And so I really resonate with that aspect of that. Yeah.
I think you're absolutely right. I mean, what you're doing now is evergreen. I mean, it's going to live forever. And, I used to hear that and think, oh yeah, sure. It's really not. It is. I mean, I was contacted about 6 months ago by a young man who I'd never met before, sent me an email and he said, Terry, I just listened to one of your podcasts and I needed to hear it at this time, at this moment. And I said, great. I said, what was the name of the podcast? And he gave it to me. I'm ashamed to even say this to you, Don, but it was like, I didn't remember the name of it. I had to go back and look it up. It was a podcast I had done 2.5 years ago that he had found that particular episode, listened to it, and it resonated with him. So what you're doing now will live on. If you die tomorrow, this will live on. People will hear that the conversations you had with other people, and I guarantee it's going to make a difference in their life. So yeah, you're right. What you're doing is purposeful right now.
That's a nice little anecdote, and it's funny because you, the part of it is there, you're a little embarrassed that you don't remember it, but that's also part of the beauty of it is it just kind of happened, and then serendipitously your friend found that again. Wow. So okay, so I guess that this is a question that has probably have a sh has a shifting answer based on what we just talked about with your cancer journey, but how have your personal strengths and weaknesses influenced where you're at now? I'm guessing that the physicality was a large part of it early on, but maybe a holistic kind of overview of that.
I'm much more of a thinker now. I have a lot more time on my hands, when I'm getting my medications, my drugs and stuff like that. I have a lot of time to sit around and think about certain things. And so I was much more of a doer when I was younger. I am much more of a thinker now, and not a thinker in, like why is there air, but more of a, what does this mean? What's the lesson here? And I spend a lot more time looking at people. Let me rephrase that. Spend a lot more time seeing people. I mean, much of the work we did as hostage negotiators was with people that were suicidal, that, or decided that they didn't want to live life anymore. And, when, however, the situation resolved, sometimes people killed themselves, sometimes we got them out. Most of the time, we got them out safely. We were successful about 90% of the time. But then you would talk to family and friends and things like that. And people would say, well, yeah, they were talking about death and they were giving things away and they were just acting differently. And your comment to them is, well, did you ask them? Are you thinking of harming yourself? Are you thinking of taking their life? And they were almost like taken aback by that question. Like, well, no. I didn't want to say anything to them. I was afraid I would put the idea into their mind. And so whenever I get a chance, I will say this. I mean, we would flat out, if we were talking to somebody and we thought they were going to harm themselves, we would say, hey, John, are you going to hurt yourself? Are you thinking about killing yourself? If they're not thinking of that, they're going to fire back on you like, no, you idiot. I'm not thinking about that at all. But if they are, you have just opened the door to say, oh my God, somebody sees me. Somebody recognizes that I'm going through this. I'm giving all the signs. I'm giving my stuff away. I'm talking about death. I'm doing all the things that you might associate with somebody that was going to end their life. But people are so afraid to ask because they think they're going to plant the seed. You're not going to plant the seed. If you think, ask. Ask the person because, like I said, if you're wrong, they'll say something goofy to you, like, no, I'm not doing that. But if you're right, you might just open the door and you might just prevent that. And then the next question, they're like, well, I don't know what to say to them. You don't need to say anything. Just shut up and listen. I mean, I'll talk your ear off, but I'm really good at listening for what's being said, but also for what's not being said in a conversation or a relationship. And so by just letting them talk, by letting them burn off a lot of that emotional energy, you just might prevent somebody from taking their own life. So if you think it, and a lot of times it's true, if you think it, if you're like, wait a minute, is that? It's true. It's happening. You're not off base. If you're thinking it, it's probably going to happen if you don't step in and do something about it. And think how horrible you would feel if a friend or a family member did actually commit suicide. And you had that feeling like, oh, I thought they were going to do it, but you never said anything. You never had the opportunity to stop it.
It adds one more inhabitant to their reality because it's like if they're truly invested, it only living in their head for that, it's I would imagine at that point it's like they're the only person in that reality, but you having, you offering to step over into that reality with them also, it makes it less lonely. I mean, it's still a lot of issues and problems, obviously,
Oh
but
yeah.
it's, you're in there
I'm not
also.
gonna solve, yeah, you're not gonna solve their problem, and
Yeah,
letting
no.
them blow off steam and stuff. I'm not gonna solve it as a hostage negotiator. What got to that point? It's kind of like, the pressure building in a bottle or something like that after you shake it. It's been building for a long time. You're not gonna solve it overnight, but you may prevent them from harming themselves or harming other people. And that, just that in of itself. And then, okay, now we can get you some help. Now we can, get you talking with people, or if you need medication, get you on medication, whatever the case may be. But being seen, it's like, yeah, I'm in this great big world. I'm in this classroom with, 300 people or 30 people or whatever it is. Nobody sees me. Like, you're right. I'm the only person in this classroom. That's my reality. That's what I see. I don't see everybody else. Nobody else sees me either.
So this might be a trivial detail, but just to make sure I'm understanding it correctly. So are these suicidal people that you're speaking with, are these people who are actively involved in hostage situations, or is this also like a sub part of the job where you're kind of on like a suicide hotline thing, or are those separate or mixed up, or am I, how am I understanding this?
So it was never a suicide hotline, but it was more, and I'll, for example, and this would happen from time to time. There's a cause, there's a causation that causes people, causes that pressure to build, and then they finally break. And let's say it's their mother. Their mother's around. Their mother's pushing their buttons. Their mother's nagging them. Their mother's doing whatever, and they grab a gun and they take their mother hostage. They lock themselves in their bedroom, and that may be an incident. They may not have their mother. They just grab a gun and say, "I'm going to kill myself," and I'm in my bedroom, and that. And so we would get called out for that as well. And so the house would be surrounded by the tactical team, and then we would be negotiating with them, trying to get them to put the gun down and come out. It didn't always have to be a bad guy. It didn't have to be a criminal that we were after. A lot of times it was. They were wanted for a crime or something like that. But many times it was just a person in crisis, and we were there, especially if they had a weapon, a gun or something like that. We were there to deal with it if it got out of hand. I mean, it did a couple times, but for the most part, like I said, we were successful of getting them out. It took time. It took a lot of time, a lot, and the other thing about hostage negotiating is, and why it was so exhausting, is you had to get in the weeds with these people. If somebody said to you, if somebody's yelling and screaming, ranting and raving about their mother, and you parroted back to them or mirrored back to them, like, "Oh, you seem a little upset with your mother." No, you totally missed what I'm saying. You have to say something like, "Man, you seem like you're really pissed at your mother." Yes, Harry gets me. He sees me. And by building that relationship, you're building trust, and trust eventually, or hopefully, leads to a point where I can get you out safely.
That's really interesting. I think that I never had thought about hostage negotiation as holding yourself hostage to an extent of that being like a suicide situation. I always imagined like criminals and having something like that. So to double click on all of that a little bit, what are some of the most important characteristics of being a hostage negotiator, and how did you learn those characteristics?
Yeah, we were very lucky. We had a psychologist that was attached to our team. He would not come out with us on call-ups, but we would train every month, and we would train based on scenarios. And so you would do a scenario, and Don, I'm really gonna tell you what an idiot I was when I started on the hostage negotiation team. Very simple. And like I said, we were trained by scenarios. So hostage taker, hostage behind a locked door in a room. Don, I spent the entire time talking to the hostage. And where we learned was in the debrief, where we would, step back, and the psychologist might say, "Hey, did you ever think this person was schizophrenic and off their medication?" "Oh, no, I didn't think about that." But I got the real harsh criticism. It's like, you realize you needed to talk to the hostage taker to try to get the person out. Talking to the hostage did you no good at all. So, yeah, I guess I got a lot to learn about this job. So totally blew it on my first try. But so this scenario-based training is how we learned, how we figured things out, how, and we would come together. I remember, so let me back up to answer your question. So we would first start with, we wouldn't say, Hi, I'm Sergeant Tucker. I'm Officer Tucker. We would say, hi, I'm Terry. What's your name? And a lot of times you don't need to know a name. Okay, what would you like me to call you? Call me Bubba, whatever. So it would start with that. And then, like I said, a lot of times we were on scene, had no idea why we were there. What precipitated this? How do we get to this point? So we would use what was called tactical empathy. I think today you can get rid of the word tactical. Just talk about empathy. And what I mean by that is, help me to understand where you're coming from or what's going on here. And the important word there is understand. And the reason I say that is if we're negotiating with, say, a homicide suspect that has just murdered three people, I wasn't going to agree that what they did was right. But I did want to understand because understanding gets to a point where it builds trust and trust gets to a point where I can get them out safely. So that was how it would start. And then we would use how and what questions. We stayed away from why questions. And we did that because think about growing up. You did something wrong. What would your parents say? Don, why did you do that? Oh, so why questions sound accusatory. Don, why did you wear that shirt today? Ooh, does Terry not like the shirt I'm wearing? Or, I can get to the same answer with a much softer question. Hey, Don, what made you decide to wear that today? It's a softer question. It lands differently than why did you wear that? So, how and what questions were important? We were taught to be curious. Always be curious. Use your curious voice. End on the, oh, you don't think you can make that happen? Or what would it take for you to feel that you're seen today? So you kind of end on that upward. I'm curious. What's the answer to this question? It's not just a question. It's a curious type of question. Parroting was important, mirroring. So we would use either the last three words or the most important words that they said and just mirror it back to them, parrot it back to them, and then go silent. And silence was a huge part of what we did, of being quiet. I know you probably find that difficult to believe because I can't shut up, but silence was very important because we don't like silence in our communication. And let me end with this. They gave us a formula, and Voss may talk about this in his book. And it was how we as human beings communicate. And I'll tell you the formula, what it means, and then I'll tell you why we got it. Formula was 7-38-55. So 7% of how we communicate a message with each other are the words that we use. And think how many times you've said something and be like, oh, I wish it wouldn't have said that, or I wish it would have said it differently. That's only 7% of how that message comes across. 38% is the tone of voice you use. Are you talking real fast and you're excited and you can't wait to get the, or are you kind of the Eeyore from Winnie the Pooh? This will never work. This is a terrible thing. What's your tone of voice? 38%. 55% of how a message comes across, so more than half, is your body language and your facial expressions. And the reason we were given that formula was, as I gave the example, if somebody was barricaded in a bedroom, with a gun, I was not in the bedroom with that person. That would not have been safe for me. So we were given that formula for the understanding that we didn't have that 55%. I didn't have the luxury of saying something to somebody and see them kind of roll their eyes like, oh, Terry, I can't believe you said that to me. So we had to get good at figuring things out, certainly based on what people were saying, but also what they weren't saying and how they were saying it.
That's such an interesting science, just all, especially because these are all things that seem so much of like the therapy kind of realm and like kind of the interpersonal skills, but then that's slapped in with these really high stake, high heart rate situations of having hostages. So how do you train to stay centered and slow and calm and have all of those interpersonal tools at your disposal while having this really high pressure situation occurring also? Because I can imagine also in your training, your first couple runs, like you're like, okay, I know how this all works. But then right when you get into the super high tense situation, like you forget all that. And so how do you train not forgetting all that in the moment?
Yeah, well, sometimes you don't because I know all this stuff, and then you go home and your 3-year-old takes a glass of milk and looks at you, and then just turns it over and pours it on the floor, and you go from I know all this stuff about communication to why did you do that? You're screaming at your kid. So yeah, the emotional part is hard, And I'm not saying we're not emotionally vested in these people, but like I said, 99% of the time, I don't even know who you are. So I don't know your story, but I want to know your story. I want to understand your story. And it's kind of like a good therapist. A good therapist is not going to solve your problem for you, but a good therapist is going to ask the right questions so that you can solve the problem for yourself. And that's kind of what we did. Like, what do you mean by, X, Y, and Z? And then get them to talk. Oh, now they're thinking about it. And Don, let me say this, and this is real important. Think about what we did kind of as when you were a kid, you would go to the park, and you'd play on the teeter-totter or the seesaw. And so when we started out negotiating with these people, their emotional brain was way up in the air. They're ranting and raving, yelling and screaming, many of them. And their rational brain is down on the ground. And so when your emotional brain is like that, I'm not talking to you about putting the gun down, letting the hostages go. I'm not talking about solutions at that point in time. I need to get you to burn off as much of that emotional energy as I can so that we can get that teeter-totter sort of to equilibrium. And by asking more how and what questions, by trying to get you to understand where you are and how we're going to get out of this. And a lot of times people just get into situations and they don't know how to get out of it. Well, let me help you. I can help you get out of it, but it's going to come to at a point where your emotional brain now is down on the ground and your rational brain is in the air. When you're dealing with your rational brain, now I can talk about putting the gun down, letting the hostages go. But until we get to that point, it's stupid to even try to talk about that. Got to get you to burn off that energy because we all make better decisions for ourselves with our rational brain than we do, more with our rational brain than we do with our emotional brain.
So what I'm hearing that is that you're really wanting to, and I would guess the way that they burn off that energy is something to you had said earlier about understanding. And so like if you're in their kind of reality with them to an extent, that helps to facilitate the burning off. But and you touched on this a little bit briefly, but how do you validate that experience or get to the point where you're understanding why they're so agitated or activated while also not agreeing with them? Because I'd imagine that, I mean, this seems like just general interpersonal skills as well, like even just like a husband, a wife or something like that. Like there's the validating the emotion but not agreeing with the perspective or some variation of that. So how do you approach that?
Yeah, and that's a great question. And it's really helping me to understand. So your mother said this to you. Yeah, my mom, blah, 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 blah. Tell me more about your mother. And we would, it would be that. And so depending on what they said, oh, so your mother really pushes your buttons. Yeah, she don't understand me at all. And then you might say, she doesn't understand you? And then go silent and then get them to tell, so you kind of walk them down the path of your mother doesn't understand you. What does that mean? How does that impact? You kind of ask the questions without asking the questions. You just parrot back to them what they just said to you and kind of walk them down their own lane to, oh, okay. How do you think we can solve this today, Don? How am I supposed to do that, Don? How am I supposed to make that happen, Don? Because what you've done with that is, think about it. You said something to me, and I just threw it back in your court. How am I supposed to do that, Don? What did I do? I got you engaged to help me get you out safely. Because I just threw, I'm not gonna solve your problem. I just threw it back at you. How are you gonna solve this problem, Don? By saying things like, how am I supposed to do that? How are we gonna make that happen? Things like that get them to come to that realization. But you're not asking those questions when they're all hyped up and they're all excited and they're all pissed off and they're scared and they don't know what's going on. When you get to that rational brain part, that's when you can start asking those questions and sort of lead them down the path that literally, all right, I see, and you explain it to them. Hey, when you come out, here's what's going to happen. I mean, the tactical team is going to tie off your door. So if you wanted to come out, you couldn't. So we want to control when you come out and how you come out. But by describing, telling them what's going to happen, it's less it's less fearful for them. They're less scared. Okay, I get it. And a lot of times it would be like, hey, when you come out, I'll come down to the scene and you and I'll talk man to man. You and I'll talk face to face. Yeah, I'd really like that. And so you get them to a point where they almost want to come out because they've solved their own problem.
This is also interesting. It just is something that I feel like is not talked about a lot in the wider culture, but it's like taking all those skills and putting them in the most extreme possible situations, which then makes it easier to backstep into less intense situations. So the next question, the follow-up from that is that I'm almost hearing sort of like a salesman-esque kind of thing where you have this ability to communicate really well, mostly with an agenda. So you're trying to get these people out of the situation, which is obviously part of the job. But how does bringing these skills into your normal relationships, which don't have agenda in the same way, are there any struggles with that of like knowing that you can do this to get something to happen? But also, you're in a different situation where you're not trying to get them to do something necessarily.
It's funny. So when our daughter graduated from the Air Force Academy, we had a deal. It's like, if you get a scholarship to college, we'll buy you a car. And so, it's senior year, and I'm like, all right, come on, let's go. Do you know what kind of cars? Narrow it down to three or four. We'll go local test drive and that kind of thing. So I'm sitting there with my daughter, and I'm like, okay, before we go into the dealership, I want to tell you something. I said, we're going to walk in here, and I said, the people are going to start. The salespeople are going to immediately come to me. They're immediately going to start talking to me. I'm the man. I'm the guy. I make the decisions and that kind of thing. And I said, I will immediately say, I'm just the transportation. She's buying the car. She's the one you need to sell. You don't need to sell me. And it's funny, Don, because the cars she ended up liking were the cars where the salesperson stopped talking to me and started talking to her. The ones she didn't like were the ones where the people didn't hear what I said. Did you understand what I just said? She's buying a car. I'm not buying it. She's buying it. You got to convince her. Don't talk to me. But they wouldn't stop talking to me, and they would ignore her. Those are the cars she didn't like. I mean, so that was just it was a great case study in how this works. And that's, so you're right. I mean, we sell every day in our lives. We sell ourselves, we sell our product, we sell the project we're working on. We do all that. So yes, life is about selling ourselves. But let me say this about when we were hostage negotiators. We never, and that's a huge word, never lied to people. I mean, people would say to us, "Hey, Terry, I'll come out, but you got to promise me I'm not going to go to jail." And I would say something like, "Really? We've been talking for 3 hours now, and I haven't lied to you once. And you want me to start lying to you now?" Or we would just flat out say, "Hey, I've been honest with you this whole thing. I've got to tell you, you're going to jail when you come out." And then we would try to deflect the conversation to something more palatable, something nicer. And the reason we didn't as negotiators was because it was a very good chance. Like I said, I talked about people's mothers. Say their mother was the one pushing the buttons that got them to do this. 3 years from now, we're back negotiating with this person again because their mother's still alive and their mother's still pushing their buttons and pushes them to a point where now we're back in it again. But if they ever felt, "Hey, Terry, the last time you talked to me, you lied to me. My credibility's gone. It's out the door, and you're gonna have to bring in a whole nother negotiator to start from ground zero." If they felt I was honest with them, we can start farther down the road because they know who I am. They've talked to me before. So that's one part of it. And think about any good relationship that you have in your life. If you have a good relationship with your parents, with your significant other, with your kids, with your boss, whoever that is, what's that relationship built on? It's built on trust. And you can have all the techniques in the world, but if people don't feel they can trust you, doesn't matter how good your techniques are, they're not gonna want to have anything to do with it. And especially in business, and I'll end with this. If you're negotiating for something, a car, whether you're in a sitting around a conference table negotiating a deal, whatever it is, we used to always say this, and I think Voss says this in his book, a yes without a how is a no. And so think, I mean, guy keeps calling your house I'm old, I got a landline. So, people keep, call the house and they're like, "We want to sell you something. We want to sell, I'm not interested, I'm not interested, I'm not interested." Okay. And finally, you get to a point where like, yeah, sure, fine. And like, okay. And then you hang up on them. Well, that's a yes without a how. There's no how for that. You know, my sales manager is going to call and set up a time where we can come out and give you an estimate, whatever it is. There needs to be a how with that. And no is not necessarily a bad thing because no deal is better than a bad deal.
Yeah. That's really interesting. So I'm kind of curious now to hear more about like how, so that's the hostage negotiation aspect of this. And then you also mentioned just generally police officer, law enforcement and stuff as well. So how did all of these interpersonal skills, and I'm imagining specifically being able to read people really well, in a law enforcement setting. Can you talk a little more about the just general police officer, law enforcement setting and how all that's what you learned from that?
Yeah, I mean, you figure out the people they're trying to play you. You know, I mean, so one of my t favorite television shows, it was a show called House. It was back in the 1990s about, you know, a doctor that basically didn't care about the rules, but was brilliant and that kind of thing. And he used to say, everybody lies to you. Well, in law enforcement, you realize that that's true. Everybody lies to you. I mean, you get on the scene, you don't know what happened. This person's telling you one thing, this person's telling you, no, they all want you to believe their side of the story. So, a lot of times, and you can use this in your personal life, somebody says something to you, or they're mad at you and they lash out at you. Now, how do you take back the power in that? You know, somebody just said, you know, I think you're an idiot. I don't think you're very good at that. You know, why are you on my team and that kind of thing? Now, you could lash back at them, you could fire on them as well, or you could just calmly look at them and say, it seems like you have a reason for saying that. And then be quiet. Because what that does then is you take the power back. And now they have one of two choices. They could be like, ah, the heck with it, and walk away, or they can start talking. And the more they talk, the more information you gain. Well, why are they saying that? Well, because the person who had the job before you treated them this way. Oh, okay, now I understand where they're coming from. So information literally is power. How do you get information? You ask the how and the what questions. You are truthful, trustful, honest with people. You don't try to play them. And think about, you know, the slimy, the scummy salespeople. It's like, you know, who were the scummy salespeople when our daughter was buying a car? They were the ones that talked to me, even after I told them, I'm not buying the car. She is. Who were the ones that she liked? They were the ones that talked to her, you know, didn't say, oh, I'm talking to dad because dad's make no, she can handle it. She let her make the decision. So it's getting as much information as you can. And it's not about, you know, an eye for an eye. It's really about keeping that power by asking that, well, you seem to have, and you can use, you seem to have a reason for saying that with anything, something good, something bad, and then just be quiet. And let people talk because the more they talk, the more information you get. And then eventually you get to a point where you have enough information where if you're making a deal, you can make your product be the solution to their problems because they've already told you what their problems were.
The it seems like X is such a great one. I like that
Yeah.
one so much because it's such a irresistible invitation to provide the information you're saying. And it, like you said, it's not even necessarily what type of information it is. It's something to respond to, it seems like. And that's such a great one. In the interest of time, I'm gonna pivot a little bit. And this is one that I've been asking people, and I'm just really curious to hear what different people think about AI in general. So what do you believe are the most important ways that AI will impact society?
So I'm old, not a big fan of AI. I just wrote my second book and I wrote it. AI didn't write it. I wanted it to be from my brain, not from an AI generated brain. That being said, I think as a cancer patient, AI has all kinds of possibilities to help me to live longer, help me, you know, help more therapies to be developed quicker and things like that. I think AI is a double-edged sword. What concerns me is there's no guardrails yet at this point in time. You know, everybody's trying to one up everybody else. And I don't know enough about it. I will tell you, I probably had I bet I had eight meetings last year with people that said, hey, you should have your own podcast. And I said, well, maybe I should or maybe I shouldn't, but I don't think I would be able to effectively put in the time I need to have a good podcast, to do the research, to do the reading because of my cancer treatments, because of my ongoing cancer treatments. And the response was, use our AI product. Our AI product will read their books, they'll read their blogs, they'll read their articles. And I said, that doesn't help me. You're giving me a, well, here's a synopsis of what we read. Well, if the person pivots to something that I don't know, or I didn't, or that, I don't have it. Well, there's nothing in my notes about that. Now I look like an idiot. So I think AI has a lot of possibilities. I can't speak intelligently enough about it, but I am concerned that we don't have the guardrails in place. And, once the genie's out of the bottle, I think it might be very hard to put that genie back in the bottle with appropriate guardrails.
Yeah, the double-edged sword part I think is just so spot on. Because I'm really interested in this because we've been really, and especially the part you mentioned about it being good for cancer treatments and like science and use in those kind of situations. Like I'm starting to get into using it in my own research and science, and I'm getting to the point where it's like, where are the boundaries on where it's we're optimizing what we can use it for while also not becoming intellectually complacent. And that boundary is not obvious where that is. And so, I resonate with that attitude as well. But it's, we don't know. We have to like try some things out in order to see where the lines are. And it's unclear if that will already have gone too far at that point. And so, we'll see how it
Yeah,
goes.
and how do we grow? We grow by doing things and making mistakes. Well, if we don't make the mistake, we let AI make it. How are you growing? How are you getting better? I have a friend who's a professor at a small liberal arts college in Ohio, and she talks about how, kids are using AI. They're, you need to write a paper. Well, I'll let it, put in some topics and let AI write the paper. What are you learning? Do you really care about learning, or are you just, this is just an assignment and I got to get through it? So especially in academia, which you were in right now, where's the line? I don't know what your professors allow you to do, getting your PhD. Can you use it? Do you have to cite it? I mean, what's your parameters and how you use it?
Yeah, that also is something that kind of what you were just saying to echo what you just said is that there's not a lot of guidelines around it right now. Like it's just people are kind of just pretending it's still new enough that we don't need to necessarily like make rules about it yet. And so it's kind of up to the temperament of the student, the temperament of the professor themselves. And so yeah, it's more it's being addressed more head on in the undergraduate labs, so kind of like as you're saying, like the students writing essays and things like that. But for grad students, it's very very much in the exploratory phase, and like kind of it's unclear how much it's either being enforced or what people think are the best ways to use it. So it's I don't know, but it's very interesting though. Okay, to finish up, I have two other questions for you. The first one is, what feels like magic to you?
Love the connection with other human beings. I mean, that is so special to me now, having had this terminal disease for 13 years. It's not about what you get. It's about what you give in your life. It's about using your unique gifts and talents to make the lives of other people better. And so many people are always chasing the next thing, the next pot of money, the next biggest house, the next nicest car, the next piece of tech, and they think by having that it's going to make them happy, it's going to make them successful, it's going to make them important, and it might, but at the end of the day, it's really the relationships, the connections, how you use your gifts and talents in life. That to me is magic.
That's a great segue into the last question. What's a piece of advice that is important to you that you could leave us with?
That's a great question. I guess I'll say this, and I wish I would have known this when I was younger. I think it's more important who you work with and who you work for than it actually is the work that you do. Find people that care about you. Find people that are willing to invest in you. Find people that want to see you succeed in life. Hitch your wagon to those people and climb your mountains together.
Yeah, that's great. And then maybe you find some love on the way in that as well. Yeah. Well, Terry, this has been a really great conversation. I've really liked unpacking the hostage negotiation stuff a lot more, because I feel like I heard a lot about Chris Voss before, and like I really liked his podcast. And so having a direct line to something similar to that has been really great. And this whole conversation has been really great.
Well, Don, thanks for having me on. I really enjoyed it, and I hope our conversation makes a difference in the members of your audience.
Me too. All right, great. Thank you for your time.
You're welcome.